All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we are here in verses 12 through 16. Looking at an interlude of prophetic revelation in regards to the contractual pact Yahweh's making with Abram regarding the real estate portion of the covenant. The prophecy itself, as with the ceremonial rite, is symbolic. It combines real physical experiential realities with spiritual realities. Time with eternity, looks at the present, looks at the future, and therefore is two-dimensional in regards to what it has to relate in interpretation. And before the main body of the contract is ratified in verse 17, in the visionary mode of Abram, when the sun was going down, he fell into a deep sleep. He became oblivious, if you will, to the realities around him, simulating almost death in regards to his posture, etc. And in that state, terror, great darkness fell upon him. And there is no indication of anything that might have caused this, as recorded in the Scripture. It's just a situation that occurred while he was in this state. And in this realm of darkness and great terror, Yahweh then communicates the prophecy, reveals it to Abram. And he begins by using an oratorical device to combine now the addendum aspect of this contract as illustrated or represented by this prophecy. To combine his offspring, his descendants, with his person in the contractual terms and promise of the covenant, as the real estate is promised to not only Abram but also to his descendants. And further, it also provides validation for them in regards to the certainty of the covenant as it relates in this fashion. The language in verse 13, "And God said to Abram, is knowing you will know." That language itself is appealing to not only Abram, but also for all his descendants. As I stated, it's oratorical, not unlike Paul saying we, speaking of the church, some of them will not die, they will experience the rapture. Some of us, as he was stated. And we had the same kind of language. So this points to the addendum as being this addition to the main contract. The descendants are now included in regards to all that this means for them. And God is making sure that Abram knows that with certainty, his descendants will know. Abram's not going to be around. He will not experience the Egyptian oppression and enslavement and the conquest or return to the land, if you will, the Exodus. His descendants will know, and it will be through fulfillment of prophecy, which is, an overt way to validate doctrine, a tangible way to validate doctrine in regards to one's life, which the properties of these things are all involved in regards to what's going on here in this passage. Now, the first historical event that will validate the covenant for Abram's offspring, that's the emphasis here, along with Abram, is that the descendants, as is stated, will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, verse 13. That your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. 43 is where we left off. You'll have to listen to the tape if you want all the other details. And it's wise to do so. I mean, if you're not in tune with all the aspects that's going on here, truly the impact of gapping this is hindered. So the land is 43, the land not theirs, is not specifically mentioned, though it is Egypt from where they will exit in verse 14. The nation whom they will serve, and afterwards they will come out with many possessions, obviously alludes to Egypt and their confinement in regards to that land. 44, now the noun strangers, our Hebrew term ger, means sojourners, normally depicting visitors or guests staying temporarily and not having rights to property as would a natural citizen. Genesis 23:4. Use of this term, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you, in regards to Abraham. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. So he recognizes he's not been given right to occupy the land that's been otherwise titled to him and to his descendants. Exodus 12:19. Seven days there will be no leaven found in your houses in the feast of the unleavened bread. For whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or native of the land. Aliens are term ger, a sojourner, one who's visiting. One may visit and be positive and join in with the Hebrews in regards to the feast. So it normally depicts visitors or guests that would not have rights to property as a natural citizen. 45, however, this day is not so temporary as they find themselves enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Now this verse itself brings out an apparent quandary in regards to the scriptures of dating, which we will now address and remove the confusion that may exist with some otherwise. Enslaved and oppressed 400 years. Now 46, the 400 years of exile mentioned in this prophecy is quoted by Stephen in Acts 7:6. Stephen uses the same chronological reference. But God spoke to this effect, that his offspring would be aliens in a foreign land, and they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. So it is an allusion to our very verse here in Genesis. Verse 7, whatever nation to which they shall be in bondage, I myself will judge. After that, they will come out and serve me in this place. 47, however, in Exodus 12, 40 and 41, and in Paul in Galatians 3:17, attribute 430 years to the exile. So you've got Genesis. Obviously, Moses is both the author of Genesis and Exodus. Genesis, using the period of 400 years. In Exodus, we see 430 years, and that time frame is referenced by Paul in Galatians. Exodus 12. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. At least that's what the New American Standard wants you to believe. We'll address this verse. And it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. That's the Exodus, 1446 B.C. then Paul uses the same time frame in Galatians 3:17. States there, verse 16, now the promise was spoken to Abraham and to his seed. It does not say in two seeds as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. We've identified that as the ultimate aspect of the covenant. And in verse 17, what I'm saying is this, the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. So both of those passages relate the situation as here in Genesis to 430 years. 48, as if that's not enough. In addition, Acts 13:19 seems to indicate 450 years before complete deliverance from exile. And this is Paul speaking again. Verse 17, the God of this people Israel chose our fathers and made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt. With an uplifted arm, he led them out from it. And for a period of about 40 years, he put up with them in the wilderness. When he destroyed seven nations, the land of Canaan, he distributed their land as an inheritance. About 450 years. So you have three different time references, chronological references, to the same subject in these particular passages. 400, as in our verse. 430, as in Exodus and Galatians. And then 450, again in the book of Acts. So 49, the apparent contradictions had brought ridicule from liberals as to the accuracy and thus veracity of the Bible. You have these types, negative individuals, that immediately jump on any opportunity to discredit the Bible. People of this ilk have absolutely no interest, no matter how much rhetoric they may expound upon otherwise, regardless of the Scriptures. Have no real interest in knowing what God's plan is. Their interest is to exalt their, quote, human intelligence, end quote, over the veracity of the truth of Bible doctrine. And these verses have rated, if you will, among the liberals and others at the top of stating, well, see, the Bible is written by man. It's not perfect. Well, then what are you following it for? Why are you so interested in it for? To discredit it, disprove it? Yeah. Again, it's just people that have no real interest in knowing what's going on. All this can be worked out with due diligence. So 50, the differences are reconciled by harmonizing the perspective from which the authors derive their citations. We will now show you from what perspective the authors are relating to in the use of their chronological time frame in this regards. All right, 51. That the Jews left Egypt in 1446 B.C. That is a firm date accepted almost across the board anymore by conservative theologians. 1446, 1445. 1445 is the year commonly embraced with the revised chronology, most recent of the most accurate chronology. We've adjusted it 1 year, at least I have, and others. So they left Egypt in 1446 B.C. That's your Exodus. So that the Jews left Egypt in 1446 B.C., point 51, we would add 430 years to address that time frame, providing a date of 1876 B.C., which is the date of the initiation of the Abrahamic Covenant. That's the year, and we've already dated it as, that the original revelation of the covenant came to Abram back in chapter 12. So 430 to 1446, dating back, obviously going back in time, you would increase in numbers before Christ. Dates is 1876 B.C. 52, so Moses in Exodus and Paul in Galatians are looking at the reality of the Jewish race in retrospect from the beginning of the promise to inherit. They're simply looking from the original covenantal manifestation or revelation in their dating process. So Moses and Exodus, Paul, are looking at the reality of Jewish race in retrospect from the beginning of the promise to inherit. 53, now the New American Standard English in Exodus. Further, Exodus 12:40. That we read is not saying the Jews, quote, lived, in quote, in Egypt for 430 years, but were sojourners for that period of time. The New American Standard is ambiguous at best, even though there is an aspect of their sojourning that included living in Egypt. Again, Exodus 12:40. See, this is how you study to show yourself approved. Now the time is what they, the New American Standard, the sons of Israel lived in Egypt. The literal Hebrew reflects a different emphasis in regards to this verse. 54, the English translation, our word time, in Exodus 12:40. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt in the Hebrew is Moshav, which means assembly, and it's a cognate to Toshav, which means sojourner or alien. 55, in addition, the Hebrew relative pronoun Asher, Asher, follows the phrase the sons of Israel. Now the sojourners, the sons of Israel, who lived in Egypt. So 56, a literal translation in Exodus 12:40 could be rendered, now the collective sojourners, collective singular, the assembly is what's been viewed, the entirety of the people. The sons of Israel, those who lived in Egypt, as reflecting upon the same racial heritage of individuals that were enslaved in Egypt, as their ancestors were. But it also includes, in the thought, anybody else, including Abraham and Sarah at the very beginning. Now the collective sojourners, sons of Israel, those who lived in Egypt, 430 years. Those who sojourned, 430 years. The same ones, the same tribe of people, the same Hebrew people that ultimately lived in Egypt and were enslaved. So that's the thought coming out of that verse. So 57, further, the lineage from Levi to Moses, from the sons of Jacob, from Levi to Moses, shows that the Israelites could not have lived in Egypt 430 years. 58, their actual time in Egypt was some 210 years of residency when Jacob's family entered in 1656 B.C. during the time of Joseph. So 1656 B.C. to 446 B.C. is only 210 years that they actually occupied the land in Egypt and was living there on a permanent basis. Not always were they in Egypt pre-Exodus, but always they were sojourners in a land not theirs. That's why Egypt isn't mentioned specifically in our verse. Otherwise, apart from that 210 years, all the Hebrews, all the way back from Abraham and Sarah, they were always sojourners. See, they were always aliens in the land in which they lived. And our verse simply says they're sojourners in the land, not theirs. 60, now the reference to 400 years before 1446 B.C., the Exodus. And our verse then dates the birth of Isaac in 1846 B.C. That's where that's the major time marker that coincides with 400 years, is the birth of Isaac. Who's Isaac? Son of Abraham and Sarah, the first descendant, the first seed that comes out in regards to the Abrahamic covenant, the descendancy clause. 61, so Genesis and Stephen then in Acts 7:6 are looking from the perspective of the beginning of Abram's offspring. Now this is an interesting tidbit. 62 is upon the birth of Isaac that Ishmael, the son of Hagar, which we will get into right after this chapter, Operation Hagar, who is Egyptian, the Egyptian, she has Egyptian ties, that's probably where she came from the bounty that Abraham, if you will, got under God's grace in spite of his malfeasance when he was there in Egypt. Upon the birth of Isaac, that Ishmael, the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, point 62, began a form of persecution with threat of subjugating Abram's descendants. We'll see that in Genesis 21. Let me get there, 9 and 10. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, that is Ishmael, the Egyptian whom she had borne to Abram, mocking. Therefore she said to Abram, drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac. Verse 63, the threat of Ishmael was of such gravity in his interaction with the new baby Isaac that it prompted Sarah to call for his expulsion along with Hagar. Obviously, a lot of other SCA emotional-driven aspects are involved in this. But there is this connection, this Egyptian connection, and the first mention of disrespect, if you will, as we say, cursing the Jew, occurs through Ishmael to Isaac. So you have this Egyptian connection that started even before they even went into Egypt. 64, the addendum now, this prophetic revelation, referred to the prophetic addendum, as it pertains to Abram and his descendants, makes the time of 400 years in our verse most pertinent, as both are being tied together now in concept. Why does Moses use 400 years here and he uses 430 years in Exodus? Because of the context. Because of the symbolism and the all the information that's embedded in regards to prophecy in this real estate contractual form. And that is, as I stated, Abraham's offspring is now being tied in through this addendum, attachment, inclusion in regards to the contract. So, what better place to date than the beginning of that descendancy through Isaac? Hence the 400 years. It's total sense. Common logic is why he would use that. See? So, figure that one out, denominational world. Point 64, again, the addendum as it pertains to Abraham and his descendants makes the time of 400 years in our verse most pertinent, as both are being tied together in concept, knowing you all will know. You all, beginning with his descendancy through Isaac. His descendants through Isaac. 65, now the mention of 450 years by Paul in Acts 13:19 is also from the perspective of Isaac. In 1846 B.C., using there the first sabbatical year observed by the Jews in 1396 B.C. as a chronological marker in retrospect. From 1846, birth of Isaac, minus 450, 1396. The conquest began, the Exodus, 1446 B.C., 40 years, they're in the wilderness. The conquest began 1406 B.C. The dating of the first sabbatical year was not until 10 years after they first went in to conquer the land. An allusion to this, at least, is the fact that the first 3 years that they went into the land to conquer, God deemed and made an imperative that they were not to eat of any of the fruit of the land because it was not yet holy. The cycle of conquest, technically under the terms of God declaring the land holy, began in the fourth year. The sabbatical year is 7 years later. That's 10 years down. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It's only five, but maybe you're quick enough to shoot in those other two. Leviticus 19:24, I don't have it written in your notes. These are just additional thoughts that have come to me. At least come to my attention. Leviticus 19:24 as what I'm talking about here. At verse 23, when you enter the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you. It's unclean, in other words. He declares it unclean. It's unsanctified. It's unholy. It shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year, all fruit shall be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. That's when the countdown begins in regards to the land being sanctified by God for their occupancy in the beginning, then, of the countdown for the sabbatical years. And quite honestly, I'm just a recipient and get the benefit from other people's hard work on that part of it. Some people have done some very good investigating work chronologically in regards to the sabbatical years prior to me. So, 66, there are no real contradictions in the dates, just different emphasis. And obviously, as that may apply in regards to each of the verses which are quoted, that's what you have to figure out when you get there in an interpretation of that. We figured out for our verse. 400 years dates as the birth of Isaac, which ties in now Abram's descendants with Abram in regards to the real estate covenant. So, anyway. I know you're just enthralled to hear all this. But I'm telling you, this is ammunition that 99.9% of believers out there do not have in regards to recourse of the satanic attack of human viewpoint against the Bible. You ever run across anyone, and they are experts out there that know the Bible and study it through intellectualism, et cetera, that will bring these things out and try to diminutize or attack the Scriptures. So, anyway. Fortunately for you, I'm not one of them. So, 67, though Abraham's offspring will find themselves in such a condition now, for this 400 years, moving on here with the prophecy, God will also judge the nation whom they will serve and deliver them from bondage, acquiring many possessions. So 68 now, this comprises both the second and third historical events that validate the prophecy for Abraham's racial offspring. In other words, this prophecy is going to validate for them in a tangible, experiential way, in fulfillment. First and foremost, they're going to be enslaved. They're going to be sojourners for this period of time from Isaac for 400 years. They're going to then become enslaved in the land of Egypt. They're going to be delivered, and they're going to walk out with much wealth. That becomes your second and third historical markers to prove the covenant pact that God made with Abraham is indeed true. Now the nation, the definite article with our term goy, hagoy, as we know, is the Egyptian Empire. Egypt is now implicitly brought into view. 70, during the process of their exit from Egypt, as we know, God will bring 10 plagues upon this nation as recorded in Exodus chapter 7 through 11. That is the form of the judgment, and then he will just essentially destroy the Egyptian army. And they go from being the world dominating power to being defenseless. When God wants to judge you, he'll kick your legs out from underneath you. 71, commensurate with the Exodus, the Jews will come out, Yatsah, a wealthy people. 72, this reality is recorded in Exodus 12, 35 through 39. As we know, they were instructed to ask their Egyptian neighbors for all their wealth and money on their way out. Yeah, we'll get out of here. Pay me off. I'm joking in that sense, but you get the idea. Now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, Exodus 12:35, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. The Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. What a way to plunder people who are more than ready to give you everything they got just to get you the hell out of Dodge. See? Leave. Goodbye. Thank you. All right, 73. Now in verse 15 of our, back to our verse. So that's your second and third validations of the veracity and promise of God to Abram for the Jews, for his descendants. So 73 now in verse 15, Yahweh turns aside from revealing the future of Abram's descendants to Abram himself. So the prophecy now makes a turn in its focus. It goes from the inclusion of his descendants as the primary purpose of the addendum back to simply Abram himself. 74, now the future for Abram personally is that he, quote, shall go to your fathers in peace and shall be buried at a good old age, end quote. So what's this all about? Point 75. The interrupting insertion, and it does interrupt it because continued information on his descendants then immediately is reinserted in verse 16. The fourth generation, they will return. So the interrupting insertion in verse 15 that refocuses solely on Abram, point 75, has a threefold purpose. A, it regards Abram as distinct from his progeny as to their destiny, indicating that the bulk of the prophecy obviously is primarily for the benefit of Abram's offspring, which I have tried to make clear. B, it adds elements of near and far fulfillments to the prophecy, you have those aspects of prophecy that you have to look at, near and far fulfillment. We've seen that, and we draw off that in regards to a lot of the prophecies in regards to Babylon. You have historical Babylon during the time of Israel, and prophecy that concerned the near prophecy, but then it reverses and goes to a far future fulfillment of the prophecy in a prophetic Babylon. See, well, you have here now, you have a far prophecy of where the Jews are going to be 400 years before they return to the land. Now we have a near fulfillment. That's simply the life of Abram in and of himself. So it adds those elements. See, it provides a chronological marker regarding the fourth generation in verse 16. You have this part of the prophecy that interrupts the flow of the history and destiny of his descendants, and that's just before he then refers to his descendants as the fourth generation. So it has impact, and it provides for us the perspective from which we are able to gauge these four generations, where they begin and where they would end, and what that fourth generation is. And I guarantee you, we've nailed it. Now here we have the first use of the term peace, in shalom in the Bible. You have the Shalom Temple on Highway 615. It means peace. The Hebrew temple. So here we have the first use of the Hebrew term shalom. This indicates that Abram's life is unique in contrast to the enslavement and the oppression of his descendants concerning the prophecy. He's going to die in peace. The prophetic picture of his descendants is they're enslaved under oppression. See? So that shows you a stark contrast in regards to their destinies. So his life is unique in contrast to his descendants of what's being revealed in regards to the prophecy. 78, now they're buried at a good old age. Kabar Bet Seba Tov is a near-term prophecy fulfilled in Genesis 25:8. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. He was 175 years old. This now, where he had dying in peace, contrasts him to his descendants being enslaved and oppressed. His dying at a good old age evidences now, in the near-term aspect of the prophecy, evidences the distinction of the present and future aspects embodying the prophecy and ritual otherwise. Again, reiterating these things that are embedded here in the verses. 80, now advanced age is not what makes a prediction intriguing here. Rather, the advanced age is, quote, good, end quote. But I, an age, good. Actually, it doesn't say old age. Gray-haired. We'll bring that out. That's all part of the symbolism that's involved. All right, 82. Abram's manner of death will be future evidence for himself that Yahweh's promise to him as a shield in verse 1, beginning of the vision, is true. We can relate this back all the way to the beginning of this vision. You don't have to be afraid of your life, Abram. And now he reiterates and designed to encourage him in that regards to deal with his STA. in that area of his life. So Abram's manner of death will be future evidence for himself, as we refocus back on Abram here, that Yahweh's promise to him as a shield in verse 1 beginning the vision is true. 83, the near prophecy in essence encapsulates the idea that the fear and dread he experienced in verse 12 has a remedy. Right. So watch this movie in this vision. Fear, great dread, fear, great darkness fell upon him. But you die in peace. So in this vision, he is able to relate a sense of remedy or comfort in spite of his emotional experience earlier in the vision. Verse 84, the legal remedy is revealed in the symbolism embedded in the prophecy. Verse 85, it is from the chronological point of Abram's death now that we can now calculate the fourth generation, Rabbi Dor in the Hebrew, that will return, our verb shuv, to Canaan. And that will wait until a week from Tuesday. Take another short break and we'll be back. We'll have class Memorial Day weekend. I won't starve you that much over the month. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. Keep us all safe and sound in our absence. That brings us back for our next scheduled Bible class. In Jesus' name, amen.